Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the channel. My name is Jacob Restituto, and I'm a musician from Northport, New York. And today we have the absolute pleasure of having Juan Saucy Peña on the channel. It is an absolute pleasure. As a 20-time platinum and three-time gold certified mixer, recording engineer, really appreciate you taking the time to be on the channel, man. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, man. No problem.
Absolutely. So for the people that haven't heard much about you and all the stuff that you had your hands on, can you give a little bit of backstory on who you are and what you do in the music industry?
Sure. So I am pretty much like a mixing, sometimes recording engineer. Sort of, you kind of fall into different roles depending on the gig.
Sure.
But, you know, my primary role and like a lot of the records I'm a part of is usually engineer and then mixing engineer. You know, sometimes you kind of come into them in different parts, you know, sometimes you'll be the person recording it. Sometimes I get called when it's already been recorded. So, you know, you never really know, but you know, you're kind of ready for whatever comes your way.
So let's start off with a super beginner question for the people that might be just joining in the music industry. And like, you know, it took forever for me to even figure this out when I was first starting off as a musician. Can you give the super basics of the difference between a engineer, a mixer, and somebody that produces? Super basic question.
Gotcha. So I mean, even producers kind of like have different sort of definitions, but you know, as far as an engineer, it's usually somebody who is working the rig, like the DAW, and kind of facilitating what the producers or artist is trying to do. So, you know, as a recording engineer, you're sort of there, whether it's with the artist or songwriter, to keep everything going, capture ideas, kind of like if they want to mess with arrangements sort of thing, you know, you do that on the fly. So like the creativity sort of keeps going. As a mixer, you know, all those decisions have already been made. And usually what you're given a lot of the time is like a final arrangement with the sonics they're trying to work with. And your job is more kind of making everything work together, you know? So like if maybe two guitars are clashing, you got to try to figure out how to make them work. So, you know, they can both be heard and the producer's vision can kind of come to life, or the artist, you know?
Absolutely.
Whereas a producer, I kind of see them in two categories. There's people who are, you know, the beat makers who like they do a lot of amazing work and they create vibes. And then there's also the other side where a producer is like the person who will work with the artist and, you know, sort of create an experience, an arrangement, you know, so whether it's making the decision of like, you know what, there's too much going on in the bridge, let's take some stuff out, or even in the recording process, I think of producers as like, you know, the person that's trying to get the best performance out of the artist, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So
that's kind of how I look
almost
at it.
To some degree, they can fall into a songwriter category too, like saying, hey, why don't we switch this section over here? Why don't we move this over here kind of thing?
For sure. Yeah, there's times where it's like, you know, sometimes they've been living with a version of the song and it takes somebody kind of going like, does this really work? Why don't we try this? And then that's the thing that kind of like makes the song, you know, go from like 80% to like 100. And it's, you know.
Absolutely. So I appreciate you taking the time to explain that for people that might not have known right off the bat. But now let's talk about engineering. In your personal experience from all that you've worked on, how much do you find that you're kind of more, like how much input do you feel comfortable giving artists and stuff when they say, hey, can you do this? Will you sit there and be like, hey, what about this? Or do you just kind of like work with what the artist gives you?
So I always sort of gauge it, you know, and like I tell this a lot to people, you know, like a lot of what I find myself doing is like you have to be technically savvy and make everything work. But there's also a lot of like psychology and stuff going on where you like sort of read the room. So you kind of like, you know, get an understanding early on. It's like, okay, you know, do they value my opinion? Are they going to want it? Or if I say something, am I going to kind of overstep? And they're going to be pissed at me, you know, and like the people I've worked with, you know, I've sort of developed relationships over the years. So like I'm comfortable and they kind of take my input, you know, into consideration. But if it was me sort of getting thrown into a session where I'm just meeting the person, I would sort of, you know, gauge it and, you know, kind of see how it goes, like test it a little bit. And, you know, it's never
skills.
A bad idea to give your input, but you kind of get an idea.
Yeah, it's pretty for somebody that is relatively savvy at reading people's, you know, reading the room. For most people that are, you can kind of tell really quickly whether or not the person's interested in your opinion.
Yeah, I've had those sessions where I'm like, dude, I'm just the button pusher today. That's cool with me, you know, or like, cool, I'm more involved in the record, you know.
Sure, absolutely. What have you found? This is a super selfish question because I'm super curious. What have you found typically as an engineer really helps your workflow? Are there things that you put into place that you that really like just take things to the next level, or speed or quality?
I mean, speed, in my opinion, is like in this day and age is everything. So I would say like preparation is key.
Mm. In what sense?
Again, depending, I sort of have like three different templates that I start with. Like one is sort of my basic, this is just a session I got a call for. So it's like basic effects and like workflow that I have. And then I have like two kind of bigger main clients that I work with. So I have like more specialized templates for what they, you know, I'm almost like anticipating what they're going to ask for. So I have everything ready to go. So when they do, I don't have to like take the extra second to like set it up, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's an extra second. It's not really that long of a time, but like when you're sort of in that moment, you know, an extra second is like the difference between, you know, life and death.
Yeah, boy. I mean, I was just talking about, I was just literally filming a video maybe within this week talking about the fact, like, I'm redoing my studio, or my, I'm in the next couple of weeks, I'm redoing my studio and taking a wall down and just restructuring it because I need more space. And, like, it's just, it's as simple as taking a little wall down, but the difference between that is, okay, now all this other gear that I haven't been using can be permanently set up because, like, for example, right. Recording my guitar, like, I have the idea, but then the idea of, okay, gotta bring out the amp, gotta set up, like, plug exactly. in the pedal. Like, that barrier to entry now kills the desire to be creative. But if it's no, all
plugged in... It does, because, like, I think of it as, like, there's, like, the creative part of your brain and then the technical part of your brain. So, like, a lot of times when you're an engineer, you're in the technical side of things. But me being... Because I used to be a musician first, so I sort of, like, think, I'm like, if I were in this position, yeah. like, this would kill my vibe, and like the yeah. you know, the 3 minutes it takes to set up, like by then I'm like, oh, you know, whatever, dude, it's fine, you know, like,
well, you start then at that point as an artist, sometimes you'll start overthinking the idea that you had. You're like, oh, this would be a killer guitar solo here, and then that you have those 3 minutes, you start thinking and you start questioning yourself, right. You know, all these things happen in those 3 minutes.
Is this a good idea? Whereas exactly. like a lot of the time you just get it down, and like if it works, it works, but you tried it, you know, sometimes exactly. it's dope and sometimes it's not, but like just getting it out, you know.
100%, man. So you're saying speed's everything. What about like just from a technical aspect? What do you have any like tips or tricks that you like just like doing to help with your workflow in general?
So typically, I use like a record track. So my main template is usually I'll have groups of tracks, whether it's leads, backgrounds, or you know, ad libs. And I typically, you know, start with maybe like four tracks, and all those will get sent to like a bus so I can control like in a macro sense. But I have like my own, like a record track that, you know, I'll kind of move up and down the session depending on what we're doing. So if we're doing leads, you know, I'll kind of bring the record track up to where the leads are. And, you know, I'm kind of keeping up with producer or vocal producer on like what I'm keeping. And I playlist everything because a lot of times in pop music, we'll have like 80 takes and then we'll go back and like comp everything, you know, so we'll listen to everything.
Oh my
and like,
gosh, it's a pretty like a engineer. I don't is that the engineering job or the mixing job to go through those comps?
No, so typically it's engineer, like mixers, and I mean you can, it depends on the situation, but a lot of
yeah,
times
they usually just get the stems. Yeah,
yeah, by the time the mixer gets it like the comp is done.
Yeah,
usually
yeah.
it's like, you know, tune time if it needs it, and then it's sort of like as close as they can get it to the final product, and you take it that little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually interesting because I guess typically when I think of engineering, I think of, you're right, the person working the studio essentially, but then there's that middle ground of, well, who's the one deciding all those comps? You know, you take 80 vocal comps. Who's that one? Is it
right?
Is that typically the engineer, I guess, or the producer? Who typically?
So it can be, but in my particular like experience, like I've been working with a vocal producer slash like songwriter. So like when I tend to do those sessions where we're comping a lot, it's, you know, me working the rig, and then it's her kind of making those decisions. But sure. then. Have, you know, because we've done it so much, like we'll typically agree on certain ones, and if I like one more than the other one, then we kind of like go back and forth. But then I've also been in situations where, you know, I got hired to be the recording guy, and then when I get there, it's like me and the artist, and they're looking at me for like yeah. sort of guidance. Is like, was that a good take? What do you think? So, sure. You know, it can be, you gotta
put on your producer hat.
Exactly.
Absolutely. No, that's really interesting for sure. So I'm curious, when now switching over gears to mixing, now you're on the other side of the table, essentially, or other side of the booth, whatever you want to call it. Are you typically mixing in the box or out of the box?
So right now I'm 100% in the box. Like, I've been sort of toying with the idea of getting some nice like analog pieces for my Mix Plus, but in my head, like, if I'm going to do that, they have to be like stepped controls, because the way it is now, especially for like the kind of music I'm working on a lot, the tweaks and like notes are endless. So like if you have something that's easy to recall, it's great. Otherwise, like it's a nightmare, because it could be like the day before the record's coming out, and then they'll hit you up with like new vocals they want you to add. So it's like, which
recreating
is
creating that sound with analog gear.
And I don't get me wrong, I love gear and I love consoles, but like I've tried it and I'm like, this sucks.
Yeah, man. It's really, really interesting. Just the more and more I hear and I learn from and talk to these people like you, you know, in the industry, been in the industry for a while, the more I'm surprised to hear how many people are mixing in the box and mixing, you know, using plugins. And it's just blowing my mind, because it just breaks every rule that I thought I knew as a, you know, kid growing up in the music industry, man. You think you need this whole 32 track thing, analog needs console, you know, like, but it's really interesting to hear how many hit records and great records or Grammy nominated, Grammy, whatever the case is, like, are being produced all within a computer. And it's like,
oh, it's crazy.
Mixed. We're talking mixing here, but like mixed.
Even on production side too, like it's all sort of like been minimalized. So it's like, there's no excuse now. You can't really say like, oh, I need all this stuff. Like,
that's the beauty of it. Cause you easily disqualify yourself, because you're like, right. Oh, I don't have a 50,000 Neve SSL studio or SSL console or Neve console.
Right, like
I can't make a good song. But that's not the case. So it's humbling, because it's like, oh, shoot, it's actually me that's the issue, not my gear.
even with the mixing thing, it's like, oh, I don't have the gear of that. And then, like, I mean, you look at somebody like Serban. Serban is all in the box, from what I understand. And, like, everything you hear on the radio, like, it's him. And, like, the only dude that does an amazing job and still does, like, the old school way that I know of is, like, Manny. Because he actually mixes on, like, an SSL.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he's perfected his workflow. For somebody like me, like, I've sort of tried it, and I'm like, dude, it's easier just to kind of like recreate the console in the session. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So tell me about that. How do you do that? What does that mean to you? Recreating the console inside the session?
I think of it, you know, the same way you would take a Pro Tools session and like stem it out on the console. I try to do a similar thing where I'll use like sub, like auxes essentially. And like, you try to add color by like using plugins, whether it's, I mean, sometimes I'll use like an SSL channel or saturation plugins. Like, a good one I use sometimes is free, is like the soft tube saturator. Mm-hmm. So it's just creating that, where it's, you know, you're trying to do what the console does naturally, but like digitally, you know. Yeah. And like the more and more like the plugin companies like are developing stuff, they're getting pretty close, man. Like, I don't know if you've ever gone to like AES or NAMM, but I remember UA had, it was like a two buttons, and one of them was like the real unit and one of them was a plugin. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard, like a lot of times I'm like, I think that's the one, and like you can't really tell. So I'm like,
yeah, it's crazy. A difference between a $300 plugin and a $50,000 console.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
And you can only use like the hardware in one instance, whereas the plugin you can use as many times, you know.
Well, that, and then the best part is, here we are mixing all this stuff and people are listening on their little tiny little AirBud things, you know what I mean? Well, and
that's the other part, that like the more I started mixing, I sort of started taking into account, because like somebody like me will notice like little nuances, and like I'll obsess over little things until like I think they're perfect. But I get into the point where I'm like, you could tweak forever, and you kind of have to look at it from like the average person's perspective. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, this is fine. They're not gonna, you know, like this is good.
Yeah, I was just talking to I guess an engineer, is the hat he was wearing on this day, and he was setting up a studio for a production house. They were doing an audio tape, I guess, like a book recording essentially, and they were an audiobook. Yeah, so like they were creating this whole like studio for building the studio out, and like the I guess producers of the track, like, now I guess producers in the sense of like the executives, not necessarily the creatives, the executives,
gotcha,
were like, yeah, but you can hear you, like, oh, they were being super nitpicky, and like meanwhile it was like pretty top notch, you know what I mean? And the funny part, right, is like, as being on the other side of it, somebody that makes music and understands a bit more like of the industry, like, Yeah, but this guy that's going to be listening to that audiobook is going to be at the gym at, you know, with 75 exactly. people around him, or on the bus on the way to work, or walking his dog, where the, you know, like he's not going to hear totally. That tiny little thing. Like, it, we obsess about, myself included sometimes, we obsess about these little details. Oh, the snare is a little too high at 4K. And, like, nobody's going to know. You know what I
mean? For me, it's just, like, I always try to, like, give myself, like, a standard, and, like, I'll always do it, even if, like, I'm like, no one's going to notice this, but, like, I'm going to know that I delivered the best possible thing I could. And, like, even when we've done, like, vocal production, like I was, you know, telling you, where we'll go through 80 takes, like, there's been times where, you know, in the beginning of it, I'm like, you know, we're cutting, like, the and the of, like, the word the, for instance. Like, minute stuff no one's going to notice, and, like, you think this is ridiculous. Like, what are we doing? And then when you sort of, like, hear the final thing, you're like, you know what, it, like, I get why we did it, and, like, it made the difference. No one might notice it, but if you, like, change it, that it's the sort of thing where a lot of people say, it's like, I don't, you know, something's off, I don't know what it is, but something's off.
Yeah.
Thing, it's, and that's where I find, like, those little things that will make the difference, but a lot of times people don't know exactly why, you know.
Absolutely. It's such an interesting debate too, though, like, that I'm constantly trying to figure out, and I think it'll be a lifelong pursuit of when to do those minute changes and when those minute changes are unnecessary and kill the track. Because I sometimes go in that opposite direction. It's like, let's perfect everything. And then it's
true.
It sounds like this sterile piece of nothing. You know what I mean?
True.
So it's like this weird battle. Cause sometimes that little difference does make the difference,
but then it's
much. And it's like this constant debate. It's like, what's the right answer? And both are yes. You know what I mean? It's just depending.
I agree. I think especially too, when it comes to whether people use, like, for instance, tuning, you know, there's like sort of two schools of thought where it's like, it's either for effect purposes or maybe, you know, this is the only time we had with the artist. We got everything we could. And, like, maybe there's like a sour note you have to fix. And, like, It's sort of making that organic and emotional, as opposed to, like you're saying, making it sterile, and where you're like, this doesn't even sound like a performance. This is just like somebody kind of like talking or singing.
But both work, which is funny. Like, it depends on the song. There are plenty of, like, multi-platinum tracks where it's like, wow, this is a really produced pop vocal, and it works. So it's like, who knows, man? Yeah. Well, never. If we knew, we'd be the, you know, number one in every industry, right? We'd have all the answers, right? So funny. So I'm curious, from your perspective, though, now that we're talking about good, quote unquote, good mixes and stuff, I'm curious how you define, and there's no right answer to this because it's super subjective, but how do you define a good mix?
For me, a good mix, like, and I tend not to sort of be very, like, super technical. For me, like, when I think of, like, a good mix, I think of a track that sort of just, it sits well, it's comfortable to listen to, like, nothing's harsh, nothing's sticking out, like, I can hear everything, you know, there's still sort of emotion behind it. And then also, like, the creative part of it, for instance, like, depending on the song, like, are you using effects to sort of tell the story, which I think it's, like, a part that a lot of times gets, you know, depending on a deadline, can get lost. Because, like, you know,
elaborate on that. I'd love to hear more on what you mean by that.
So, you know, like, you think of a mix, you think of, like, okay, I'm trying to make this song sound as good as it can, you know, but, and then for me, I get to that point where it's like, great, it sounds good. Like, now let's get to the good stuff, which is sort of like listening to the lyrics of the song. And if there's, like, a sad part, how can I take that sad line and enhance it? So maybe it's like a dramatic reverb throw or something to make the vocal stand out. Like, the one I can think of that's always, like, the ones that come to mind, it's like, there's a Billie Eilish song with the mixer Rob Kanelsky. The line is like, her head's underwater, and he filters her voice, and it literally sounds like she's underwater. So, like, that sort of thing I love to try to, like, incorporate in mixes I do, because it's the difference between it, like, oh, this sounds good, to wow, this is like a story, and, like, this enhanced the song, you know.
Absolutely. I completely understand what you're saying. I feel like, to some degree, being fully honest, I feel like that's not done enough. I feel like the fact that we notice when it happens means that it's not happening in every track.
I always try to just get, like, the sonic part of it done, and then, like, when it sits well, that's when I, like, sort of put on my producer hat, be like, what can I add subtly that's gonna, like, not get in the way, but it's gonna, like, they're going to hear and be like, holy shit, this is
Yeah,
dope.
It makes a difference. It's the ear candy. It's not, I wouldn't know if I would consider that ear candy, but like, it's like you said, production or storytelling through engineering, essentially.
Exactly.
Which is a really, really cool concept, and I think it makes a big difference in the end. That would 100%. That's a great answer. I really appreciate that answer.
Yeah, man. That's like I say. That's the fun part. Like that's the part I look forward to. Like once everything sits well, I'm like, okay, like let me get to it. You know. Like,
yes, absolutely, absolutely. Now, on a slightly different perspective or question, but kind of in the same line of it, is working on so many songs that you have and somebody that have done so well, quote unquote, you know, to the standard of music. How do you define a hit song, or what do you think? It's a two-part question. How do you define a hit song, and the follow-up to that will be, what do you think makes that a hit song?
Man, I would say, I mean, a hit song is just something like a song that just resonates with like a lot of people in like a sort of very broad or specific way, depending on how the song is laid out. And like, obviously, like, you know, you have to kind of gauge the commercial success or how much it sells. But for me, it's just something that sort of resonates with the audience they're trying to reach and like connects and, you know, clearly the outcome, you know, the response from that audience is like clear. And I mean, what was the second part as far as,
so how do you think that they achieve that? So like how the one with the first part you answered, thank you, with how do you define it? Now, what do you think leads up to that? Again, completely subjective.
It's funny because I feel like sometimes you have an idea that it's going to be a big song, and then there's other times where, you know, people really have no clue, because I've sort of been in both situations. So like the first big record I've ever worked on was with ASAP Ferg. It was Plain Jane, and we did that record. It was like 3 a.m. It was like a typical, because I used to work with him like every day. We did that for like a year and a half, almost 2 years. And it was just like another typical day. No one really thought much of it. Like, and he actually released it for free. He was doing this thing where it was like Trap Lord Tuesdays, put it out. No one ever thought that was going to be like a big hit. And then it just gradually built and like became like one of his biggest songs. Whereas like the first record I worked on with BTS, like everybody kind of knew, you know, it was like, this is something different. There's something special about it. But I think achieving what it became, it took a lot of like the nitty gritty work, like we were talking about, where like we were obsessing over different words, the comp, like how it felt overall, like whether it needed backgrounds in certain places. And like, it was me and this vocal producer I work with a lot, Jenna Andrews, like she would go through, we would record a bunch of different things, and then we'd listen back and be like, no, that's too much, let's take these out. So it was sort of like trial and error until it felt cohesive. And I feel like because we all sort of had an idea of like the, you know, the magnitude or the potential it had, like I felt like it was sort of necessary to go through every possible like thing. So I feel like when you have an idea, you go through all the motions and you try everything because you know, like this could be a huge song, you know, but there's other times where it's just very raw and creative and it happens and it becomes like a huge thing. So it's hard to tell, you know, like sometimes you get an idea, and I've been in the situation where you think it's going to be big and like nothing happens too. So it's a funny thing, man.
It is for sure. And again, there's no right answer. Cause if you had the right answer, like, you know, you'd be
knocking them out every week.
You know? Exactly. Exactly. On the BTS track, because I believe you did a couple. You did Dynamite, you did Butter, and you did the Jason Derulo remix, right? With
It was like Dynamite, Butter,
and Savage Love, the remix.
Savage Love, and then Permission to Dance was like the last one we
did. Oh, yes. Okay, yeah, cool. Where were you in that the creative process? Were you the engineer or the mixer for those?
So for Dynamite, it was mostly vocal engineering, which was like sort of what we were talking about, where it was, you know, comping, arrangement stuff sort of thing.
So like, can I ask a quick question about that? So I'm not super familiar with that aspect of the industry yet. So vocal engineering is, I guess, because vocals come in on a different day, you have a vocal engineer come in?
Or so pretty like, much in this situation, because they're in Korea, they record in Korea, and this was like COVID had just started, so like no one's traveling, you know? They're recording in Korea, and then we would receive files of like what they were recording. So our job was to work pretty much on the vocals, perfect them, And then there was a separate, it was sort of simultaneous. There was a producer working on the music and the track. And we were sort of staying fluid in the sense we would get like an updated track, put it in our session and, you know, go from there. And it's, so vocal engineer is mostly where you're sitting on the track and you're making it work. Like it has to feel right. Like the timing has to be right, you know, because a lot of the times, like the track that we're recording to was just sort of like the rough idea.
Yeah.
So when we receive vocals, they're sort of locked into that. But then if the producer changed the production a little bit, it's going to like feel off. So it's like that sort of thing where you either nudging or like fixing little things mm-hmm. that, you know, a lot of people aren't noticing right away, but in the grand scheme of things make the big difference.
Absolutely. For sure. Absolutely.
So for that one, it was mostly that, I did like rough mixes, but because of like the magnitude of the track and like at that particular time, I didn't have as much credits under my belt. So like it went to Serban clearly because he's like the G, you know, for mixing. And then for Butter, it was interesting because I was sort of there.
That was Dynamite originally you were just talking about?
Dynamite, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
For Butter, and then for Savage Love was a similar situation because like, you know, they couldn't travel. For Butter, it was unique because the people who produced the track also wrote the song. So I was there from the very beginning of like the songwriting sessions. With the like whole crew of people, and then pretty much brought it up to like the rough mix, and then it went to I went to Serban. So a lot of those bigger tracks, it's hard to sort of get into like the mixing role unless you already sure. have like, you know, the name behind it. But even going through the experience of it, you kind of understand like the process and like what they're looking for, which is what I always try to think of, like being on the end of like, oh, we're the ones getting the mix. I'm thinking like, oh, like when I send the mix, like this is what I need to do because like this is what they're looking for, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of it was engineering, vocal engineering, and yeah, Permission to Dance was like pretty much the same sort of thing. But that one was like, it was like four or five, like 400 and something vocal tracks, which is like...
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, they were all huge, but that one in particular, I remember. I remember printing the stems, and I'm like, I don't ever want to do this
again. So, what does that mean in the sense of how many of those did you use, or did you use all 400?
So, you know, there's like seven dudes in the band, and then on top of that, they'll do harmonies, backgrounds, and then we'll add harmonies and backgrounds. So it's just layers, textures, stuff that if you take out, you don't necessarily notice, but you're like, that hook doesn't feel as big. Like, what's going on?
So you ended up using 400 vocal tracks.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So how many comps and stuff? That's like 1,500. I mean, that's even so if you like four takes for each track, that's 1,600 tracks or comps.
Oh, dude, it's. I mean, I feel like for the backgrounds and stuff, like, we comp, but we didn't go as crazy
as.
But it's still like... It's a process.
Oh, shoot. People put it, you know what, that shows that they put in the work, and you know, and you guys, the whole team included, you know, everybody in the creative process put in the work, and it's a deserved hit, you know what I mean? Like, I think people are like, totally. Oh, I did three takes, I did seven takes, I worked my butt off, you know, like, why is this not a hit? Well, you know, people are putting in the work, you know, and that's actually very impressive.
No, totally. I think I remember, I think for Butter, too, there was like a thing where we had a certain deadline, and in order to sort of meet it, we ended up like taking sections of the song. Each of us took a section and like comped, and then we put it all together in one session just because of like the sake of time, you know?
Sure.
You're just trying to stay as efficient as possible, which is another fun part where you're like, I can do this, but how do I make this fast and like efficient, you know?
I very much understand that, actually. It's like debating that in my own life at the moment of like, okay, quality versus quantity. Where is that line? Like, I can do this faster, but where is that line of quality? And who cares in the end? Like, do people care more about the speed of it? Do people care more about the quality, or where is that fine line? I hear you, bro. I hear you.
Yeah, no, I juggle where my goal and everything is to try to do everything like as fast as I can, but to the standard that I hold myself.
Yes, absolutely.
And if I could do that, then I'm happy. But sometimes it's hard, and sometimes you gotta like sacrifice a little bit of the quickness in order, because you know, you don't want to put something out there that's not gonna be good or not up to your standards. You know, it's like, but I play with that, and I'm always pushing it because I'm like, dude, if I could do that, then you know,
I hear you, man. Absolutely. That, I think that, that whole conversation of all the people involved in the BTS production, all that, like we were talking about, you know, Serb and everything, is a great segue into this next conversation, next question. I'd love to talk to you about, like, how you essentially got to where you are in the industry. And I think that part of the reason I like talking about this is because when I first started out, and I think that when so many other people start out, they're like, okay, that's really cool that we're doing all this stuff, but like, how did you even get there? Like, I remember one, for example, one memory I had is I dropped out of college to do music full time. And I was like, at the time, this was around like 2014 era, Ed Sheeran was just starting to get a little bit, like some pretty good traction. He wasn't the superstar he is today, but like he was like, I think on tour with Taylor Swift and stuff. Like, so he was getting, doing his rounds of interviews, and I was like super inspired by the guy. And I was like listening to every interview. And one thing that kept coming up in all the interviews was the fact that in 2012, he had done 312 gigs. And here I was, just dropped out of college, and I was like, that's sick. Like, I'm ready to work. And I just couldn't get a single gig. I was called hundreds of restaurants and bars and venues, and like I'd get a gig a month. And I'm like, I just don't even know how. Like, I'm willing to do it. I just didn't know how. And like, so right. That's where I started this process of like, I'm going to document everything I do, because I believe in where I'm going. I have some big dreams and stuff, and I want to show people along the process of how I got there. The roadmap's not going to be the same for everybody, but right. They can get little ideas and stuff. So I love hearing other people's perspectives to share. Like, how did you get there? What's some sort of roadmap of connections or anything like that?
So, I mean, I always tell people too, like, you know, it's good to learn from people that like, let's say, you know, you're trying to get to where you are or where I am right now. It's good to learn from people, but I always tell, like, you know, no one story is ever going to be the same. Absolutely. Like, every situation is sort of different. For me, I mean, I'm originally South American, like from Colombia, and I grew up in upstate New York in this tiny town called Owego, which is like nothing going on up there, dude.
Owego?
Owego, New York, yeah.
So not Oswego.
No, Oswego is further north. It's like closer to Canada. This is close to like the biggest city you could think of, like Binghamton.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. I'm a native New Yorker, so I know. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So yeah, it's like near Binghamton, but I started playing in metal bands up there. And that was like my thing. I was a drummer. I played bass. And I became interested in like audio engineering my last year of high school. I had no idea it was like even a profession. And I did like a 2-year program in a community college in Binghamton, used to record my band. And then I decided to move closer to New York because I was like, dude, this is dope. I want to keep this going. Originally, like the band was coming with me, but, you know, it ended up not happening. But, you know, me and my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, like we made the move. And then I went to a 4-year school in like Westchester, and it was through a teacher there that I landed like my first internship, and it was, it was like my freshman year. I just connected with this teacher. He was great. And he connected me with the guy who's my manager now, but at the time he was managing Daddy's House Recording Studios for Puff. And wow. That was my first internship. That was sort of like my introduction to like the music industry. And, you know, it was not pretty, but you know, you learned a lot. Like,
so tell me a little about that, because I think that we glorify what it looks like, and sometimes it really kind of sucks.
No, dude, so elaborate. I mean, my teacher kind of told me what it was, and like, you know, I'm the kind of person where, like, I want to know like the shitty stuff because I want to know what I'm in for. But it's, you know, it's like doing food runs, cleaning toilets, like being the bitch. But at the same time, you're in these rooms and like, you learn to multitask in the sense of like, okay, I'm going to like fit whatever needs you may have, but I'm also watching how these records are being made and like what this guy's doing, how he's like carrying himself, what he's doing to like the stuff he's recording in order to like enhance it. So I
interned and all the subconscious stuff that you're picking up too, like
how to deal with clients. Yeah, and that's what I tell people is like, you could learn the rig, but it's sort of like this etiquette, how to deal with people.
Yes, exactly.
And like how to deal with situations you find yourself in. Cause sometimes like it's great. Everybody loves you. Sometimes you have somebody who's pissed off at you, and like, how do you diffuse the situation without somebody like freaking out, you know?
Absolutely.
But I spent I think it was 4 years there. And I did from intern sort of assistant. And then at the end I was like running sessions. But it ended up closing down cause I think the lease was up and didn't get renewed. And after that, I spent a year at a smaller studio, but then I ended, after about that year, I think it was like a year, year and a half, I ended up working at, it was like Downtown Music Publishing. They had their own studio in Soho. And that's sort of like the main hub where I met a lot of like the clients I still work with. Like that's where I met Jenna. I met Ferg and I met Joey Badass, which I still work with occasionally when he's not, you know, on the road. But from there, I would say another 3 or 4 years sort of doing sessions and, you know, it's all sorts of stuff, which that's why I love that place. It was like hip hop, pop. Mm. We would do, like audiobook stuff. I remember we used to do morning sessions where it was like sync stuff. So like, I would have to be there to like, make sure shit ran smoothly for like a Kohl's voiceover commercial, you know, like the woman who's like this weekend at Kohl's sales, yeah. You know, like that kind of shit.
Yeah, that's funny, man.
And I was pretty much there until right before COVID started. Like they were in the process of like expanding the facility, but then because of COVID, it got shut down.
And so then are you still based in New York?
Yeah, I'm based in New York. I travel a lot to LA now, but you know, I've toyed with the idea of moving out there, but as of now, I'm still, you know, New York based.
Yeah, man. New York for life, baby. New York for life.
Yeah. Nah, dude, I've been out there, but I don't know. East Coast forever.
100%, man. Absolutely. I've been out there a couple of times more recently, and I'm like, it's cool, but it's not New York, man.
It's different, yeah.
It's very different. It's very, very different. I like the New York culture of, like, you tell people how it is. In L.A., it's like...
That's exactly it.
Is a little, they don't tell it how it is, you know, and I was like, no, man, I don't like that. I like the roughness of New York.
I do too. That's what I say. It's like, I would rather be like, you know what? I don't fuck with you, but like, we're going to do this because this is the gig as opposed to just like.
Sure. Man. Dude, it's so funny. Last time I was in LA, literally the day I got back, I was picking up my car. My sister lives in Queens and I was picking up the car from Queens because I left it there. And I literally pull out and immediately some guy gives me the middle finger, right? I'm like, welcome to New York, baby.
Come home.
Oh shoot, it's so funny, man. So to recap that, to segue back to what you were talking about.
Yeah.
based on the storyline, it seems like, I mean, how many years in between? It seems like it's been a while you've been in the industry.
It has. So I think like I moved to closer to New York. I think it was originally like 2012.
Okay.
And then I think it was like three and a half years like working for Puff. It was like a year in between like a smaller studio, and then like in downtown it was like 4 years or something like that.
Yeah. So it's one thing I really just want to reiterate and recap of the story is in so many of these interviews that I've done and so many people that have seen, you know, great quote unquote success or however you want to define it, like a lot of these stories sound very similar in the aspect of like you put the work in, man. Very, very similar story. I just was speaking to DJ Swivel, who's a producer out in LA, and
He's dope, man. Yeah,
he's a great guy, but very, very, almost exact similar story. He moved from somewhere else, but to New York, got an internship at very low level, was doing the food running, was clean. Literally, it's like word for word, doing the food running, cleaning the toilets, getting coffee, and so many other people that I've spoken to have the same story, but now look where they are now, and it's just like being willing to humble yourself and do that work.
Totally.
Leads to getting to where you are now.
I always looked at it, and then there was like, because for instance, like after Puff Studio closed, you know, at that point I was doing sessions, and you know, when I started working at Downtown, because like, you know, I didn't know the owner as well as I had the relationship with the past owner, so like I had to do the whole, you know, going from running sessions to sort of going back and like proving myself, and like that can be, you know, excruciating and like annoying. Sure. But like, you know, having done that, I learned more and was put in, you know, these situations where, you know, it sort of elevated me to another level. And like, another thing I always tell people too, is just like, you know, you're always sort of preparing for the opportunity to come. And like, when it comes, you got to be ready, you know? So that's how I looked at it. I was like, you know what, like I'm running food again, but whatever, there's going to be a point where like, somebody's not going to show up. Somebody's going to get sick. They're going to need somebody to run the session and I'm going to be ready, you know? So exactly. It's like, I always, you got to look at it sort of in that way, because otherwise, like, you drive yourself crazy, because it's, you know, music is, there's ups and downs no matter what, you know. Even like the big dudes who do like the big records, like, you sort of learn to ride the wave, and you know, even as artists, where they'll have a hit and that could be it, you know what I mean? Like,
it's terrifying. It's terrifying. I would say all the time, I'd so much rather never ever ever have a hit than to have a one hit wonder.
Yeah, that's
like,
the
don't give it to me and then take it away. Like, just don't give it to me at all at that point, you know what I mean? I'll just chase it forever rather than have it and then lose it. Oh my gosh, no way.
Exactly. And that's what people say, is if you got a hit, you got to be working twice as hard. You can't get comfortable.
100%.
Following that up is the hardest thing you'll ever do, you know?
100%. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I really appreciate that, man. You had some really, really great perspective. I want to play a 2-second little fun little game that I've been doing in the introducing to the interviews called Overrated Underrated. And I'd love to hear your quick little responses. I'm going to throw a couple things out there and you say if it's overrated in the industry or underrated in the industry.
Okay.
All right. We're going to start off with LPs, like long form albums.
Like albums?
Yeah, as opposed to like singles. Singles are LPs, I guess.
I would say underrated, but you know.
Okay, cool.
I love albums. Like,
sure.
But, you know, nowadays.
Following the coattails, vinyl?
Vinyl? I would say overrated. I don't know.
Okay.
I love vinyl. Don't get me wrong. I just feel like it's been romanticized a lot. Like,
sure. Absolutely. No, it's totally subjective, and I love hearing just people's perspectives. Absolutely. It's fun. Console gear.
Console gear, like.
Like the Neves and the SSLs and stuff.
Oh man, this is a tough one. I will say overrated only because of like the cost. Like what you can achieve now with plugins, it's so close that it's like.
Let's follow that up with what's an underrated plugin then.
An underrated plugin. Let me think. I'm trying to think, but everybody.
Personal taste. Again, complete personal taste.
Let's say the soft tube saturator, because like it's free and like not a lot of people use it. Like they typically use like the Cavitator, or I think Waves has like a new one, but it's free and I'm a huge fan of it. It's dope.
Sure, absolutely, man. I hear you. All right, last one. Throw a little knife out there. Los Angeles. Just kidding.
You know what? Oh, man.
I'm just kidding, man. What?
Let's say overrated. It's just, I don't know.
That's funny.
I love my LA people, man. I got friends out there. It's just, I don't know.
Oh, shoot. It's just because we had that conversation. It's too funny. We're both New Yorkers, man. That's why I said it. Shoot. That's funny, man. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, man. Last question I'd like to wrap it up with everybody that I have on the channel is, what is something that you currently know now in your career that you wish you knew when you first started off?
Something I wish I knew when I started?
Yeah, that you know now.
I would say, I don't know. I almost wish I don't know if I would change anything, just because I feel like the idea I had of what it was like going to be, like sort of playing the role of engineering, was like so different than like it actually is. But I almost like the fact that I didn't know it, because I learned more by kind of screwing up at times and like, you know, being in a situation where like, dude, I don't want to ever be in that suck. You know what I mean? Whether it's like, if I knew about it, I feel like I wouldn't have even in the mindset I was when I was younger. I'm like, I don't know if I would want to do that. You know what I mean?
I think that is actually a great, great answer. That's a cool answer. I think that most people don't give answers like that. They've given, you know, they'll give specific things that they've learned over the years. But I think that's actually a really, really great perspective. And like, so I just recently put on a concert like in the past couple of months, and people like, oh, like, what do you think? What would you do differently? And I was like, honestly, like, it sucked putting on this concert.
It's like,
but like, I gave the same answer. I was like, I wouldn't honestly do anything different because I learned so much. I know next time there are things I'm definitely going to do different. But from this, like, I learned so much that I don't know if I'd want to give that opportunity up of learning it. You know,
no, exactly.
I keep the discomfort over the learning. Yeah. You know.
Because when you're in those situations, like, that's what you really learn. You're not just like somebody telling you like, oh, don't do this. Like when you're in that situation, whether you fucked up, you lost a vocal or like something's not working.
Oh, shoot.
Like, you know, like that's
my stomach
know,
just
like,
dropped on that one, dude. How do you handle that?
Oh, dude. I mean,
it sucks.
I had one that I remember specifically where we were recording. I don't know what happened. Some weird glitch happened. And then
that's the worst, man.
We opened the session back up and it was like all blank, and like I somehow the audio files got sent to like a different folder or something, so I had to literally like find it and then spot them back in the session, but it, you know, in that moment, and that you're thinking like, fuck, dude, I'm screwed, you know. Absolutely. And you learn to think calmly on your feet instead of freaking out, because otherwise you're going to do more stupid shit, you know.
Yeah, for sure, man. Absolutely. No, it's terrifying.
No, dude. I mean, but see, I, you know, as much as they suck, like we're saying, I welcome that, because then you learn how to fix it in case you're ever in the situation, and then you're training your mind to sort of be calm and like solve problems whenever they come your way, you know.
Yeah, man, I couldn't agree more.
It's a win-win. That's how I try to look at it, you know.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. You know, like, as much as it sucks, like, you'll never, one, you'll never do that again, or two, you'll know how to handle it if it comes up again.
Yeah. And if you do, you know how to fix it. You know?
Absolutely. So, shoot, man, that's so funny. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. If you could hang out for 30 more seconds, I just want to say thank you so much to every single person that made it this far in the interview. You guys are the true ones. Appreciate you very much. Definitely go check out everything that we've been chatting. Definitely listen. Go back and listen to this a second time. Take some notes and go back and check out all the tracks that Juan's been working on, and all the stuff that follow him on social media and everything. Best way to support this channel is checking out my own music and subscribing on whatever platform you're listening to. Thank you so much for watching and hanging out with us today. Have a great day. God bless and peace out.